Welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading.
International best-selling author Natasha Lester hardly needs an introduction. She is known around the world for her immaculately researched and beautifully written novels about inimitable trailblazing women. Her army of devoted readers return to her books time and again to be transported into the past. Welcome, Natasha.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate. It's so lovely to be
here. It's such a joy. I feel like I sort of know you through your social media alone, which is always a good sign.
I know, and having the same publisher in the US has been really nice too, so I do feel like we've got a lot of links in our back.
For sure. And I think we have the same publisher in Australia as well, don't we? I think.
Oh yes, we do. Yes.
So we're moving along parallel lines. So we were talking a little bit before we came on about your background, and I'm fascinated by that because your background is in marketing and public relations. So I'm really keen to just dive in and say, how did you make the leap from that into writing, and whether you felt your skills were transferable?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I always wanted to be a writer. It was the dream that I had from the time I was, you know, I could read books and understood that writers wrote them. But as we were talking about before, I'm from Perth in Australia, which is quite a small, isolated capital city. And so back when I left high school, which was like decades ago now, there were no
you and me both.
I know. So long ago. There were no universities here in Perth offering creative writing degrees back then. They just didn't exist. And again, at that time, it wasn't really a thing for people in Australia to travel to other cities to do university. It wasn't easy to do. So I didn't even occur to me to go interstate for that. So I didn't know what to do. My dad was an accountant and he suggested I do a commerce degree, because I think he hoped someone would take over his accounting practice in later years. That did not work.
Backfired on him.
I know. So bad. So sorry, Dad. But I looked into this commerce degree and realised it had this kind of component called marketing and public relations, and that had a writing element to it. So in the absence of any better ideas, I did that at university. So then I worked in marketing and public relations for about 10 or 12 years, roughly. But the whole time there was still this writing idea buzzing along in the back of my mind, and I'd write little pieces every now and again, but nothing much. And I was, you know, busy and all that kind of thing. And then we were working over in Melbourne. I'd gone over to Melbourne to work with L'Oreal Paris, in fact, as the marketing manager for their Maybelline brand of cosmetics. So maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's Maybelline. That was me.
Was that you? Oh, that's catchy.
So that was super fun. But then my husband, who was also from Perth, had to come back to Perth for his work, which meant quitting my job at L'Oreal and coming back with him to Perth. And I knew that I wasn't going to get the same kind of job here in Perth that I had in Melbourne, because at that time companies didn't have their head offices in Perth. They were mainly Sydney and Melbourne based. So I thought, well, my two options are I get a kind of a marketing job that won't be as interesting, or I do something else. And this little voice in my head said, what if you looked at that creative writing idea that you've been holding on to for all that time? And so I thought, oh, maybe I'll have a look into that. And by that time, the universities here did have creative writing degrees. And so I thought, well, what if I just went back to university and did that and just found out if I was any good at it? Because, you know, you think you might love it, but what if I didn't like it? And what if I was terrible at it? So a university framework, I felt, gave me the space and time to find out those things. And so I did that university degree, loved it, got a couple of things published. I thought, okay, maybe I'm not that terrible at it. Maybe I'm okay, so I'll keep going. And then that kind of rolled into doing a master's degree in creative writing, where I wrote my very first novel, which was not historical. It was like contemporary literary fiction. That won a prized non-published manuscript here in Australia, and then that led to a publication contract, and it kind of all rolled on from there. So that was back in 2010, in fact, that my first published. Yeah, so that's kind of the story, the part of history of how I came to be a writer.
that's quite a journey, though, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the work that you put into it, there's no overnight there, is there? It was a lot of hard graft.
Oh, God, no. In fact, I remember it was 5 years from the time I started writing my very first book, this kind of contemporary literary creature, until the time it was published. And over those 5 years, as well as writing that one book, I had three babies.
Oh, yeah, the small matter. My God. Although I do think that having, because I started writing at a similar timescale to you, so sort of 10 years ago, and my son's now 12. And I remember when I was pregnant and when I first had him, I felt creatively that was one of my, some of my best years. I felt really fired up. So I don't, I think it's like the birth of children, the birth of books are sort of symbiotic in some way, possibly. It really helped me personally. So I think where some people might think, oh, three kids and writing books. I don't know. I think the energy that you get from it.
Yeah, I agree that it. A lot of people think that having children and writing a book at the same time is something that would be impossible to do. But at the time when I was doing it, I thought, oh, this is so difficult because the only time I had to write was during my baby's nap time. So it would be, you know, anything from half an hour if it was a bad day to 2 hours if it was a good day.
Yeah.
And that taught me that, you know, there was no such thing as the muse. Actually, writing was sitting down in your chair and turning ideas that you had at all other times of day, like when you're breastfeeding or when you're walking the baby or rocking the pram back and forth to get them to go to sleep. All those ideas that were bubbling away in those kind of boring moments, what you need to do was turn them into sentences and paragraphs and chapters and eventually a book. And to do that, you had to sit in your chair and type. And so I would do that in their nap times, and it meant that it taught me not to waste time because I didn't have time to waste. So it taught me, A, to be efficient. It taught me that bum glue is one of the best tools a writer can possibly have.
I talk about bum glue all the time. You're absolutely right.
Exactly. Yeah, and that idea that you, any moment of time in your day can be used to writing if you choose to. When you have plenty of time, it's very romantic to think about, well, I'm just going to make sure I have the right ambiance with a glass of red wine and candles and the muse descending down upon me. But that's not reality for most women, certainly, I think. So so it taught me a lot of good things, actually, and I'm really grateful for that experience. Although at the time I thought it was challenging, but it was a good challenge, it turned out.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said that, because that, for me, is about demystifying this sort of act of writing. Yeah. You know, you don't need to swan off to Provence and go to a writing retreat. No. You don't have to light the candles, like you say, and wait for the moment of inspiration to strike, because most 99.9% of writing is just hard graft, and where you write it down is irrelevant, whether it's on the back of a, you know, I don't know, just a piece of paper as you're on the bus or as you're rocking the baby, whatever, as long as you get those words down, it's sort of, I think it concentrates the mind. Because I remember feeling those panic, if I don't do this now, when will I do it? So I have to write it down in whatever, you know, haphazard, sloppy format it comes out, at least just get the words on the page. And you're right. It's so interesting to hear you say that, because I could not agree more with what you're saying. And I hope that that actually acts as a sort of spur to some people to make you think that there is no perfect time. No. That does not exist. No. And often you are juggling it around work and children and other commitments. And it's about prioritising that as much as you would the other commitments.
Oh, 100% agree. And it's interesting. I used to do a lot more teaching of creative writing than I've done in the last couple of years. And people often used to say to me, oh, can you tell if someone's going to be a successful writer or not? And I always say, you know, you can't tell by the words they've got on the page, because you can have some people who hand in really amazing assignments and they're so talented and you think, wow, this person could be an amazing writer, and others that might hand in something that's a little more pedestrian, but it's the ones that take the time to sit down and finish a piece of work that are the ones that then go to be writers. And that's maybe one out of 500 students that might do that. So it's that makes the difference at the end of the day. You know, I can have the most talented writer in a writing class, but if they never sit down and make the time to write, then they're never going to amount to anything. So it's really a big, you know, I say it's talent, it's luck, but it's hard work. It's those three things coming together.
It's the perfect. Exactly. It's all the stars aligned, but it is, but you're right, it's equal doses of all of the talent, the tenacity, but also the absolute gritted teeth determination that come what may, you will turn up, like you say, you will paint your bum with glue and you will sit down and you will write come what may, and that is sacrosanct, and that's your time. So Great advice, yes. Actually, for anyone listening that thinks, oh, I don't know if I can do it. Everybody can do it, especially if you've got the will and the passion. So moving on, Natasha, to your, because I'm really interested actually as well, because you say your first novel was a contemporary romantic sort of fiction, and then you've really inhabited the space of historical fiction so beautifully. Your latest book, The Three Lives of Alex St-Pierre, I hope I pronounced that right, is such an unforgettable read. I loved it so much. I particularly love the character of Alex. To me, she sort of sums up what is so fantastic about so many wartime women, regardless of what country they come from, because she's, you know, resilient and subversive and irreverent and hardworking and funny. You know, she's that great mix, almost a sort of vulnerable but quite ballsy. And where does she come from? Where is she? Was she from your imagination, or is she an amalgamation of women you know? Where did Alex pop from?
I guess it's interesting, isn't it? This where do characters come from? And I think she is one that has actually been bubbling away in my mind for many, many years. I wrote a book back in 2019 called The French Photographer, and it was loosely based on the life of photojournalist Lee Miller, who wrote for Vogue during the Second World War. She covered the war for Vogue. And she had this tragic life where she wrote and photographed these amazing pieces of reportage during the Second World War. And then after the war had ended and all the men returned to their jobs, she was kind of demoted by Vogue to going to St. Moritz to report on the social season and to writing recipes, in fact. She reported the US Army's first use of napalm in St. Malo during the war. She's got that iconic photograph of herself in Hitler's bathtub in his apartment in Munich. She reported on the work of the nurses and the women who were in the crumbling bombed towns that the armies had passed through and all of that. And then here she is writing recipes after the war. And she was such a strong, ballsy, gutsy woman and brilliant. If you read her reportage, it's just incredible. But God, how much must that have felt to have been told that the only job available for you because you're a woman now is to write recipes. That must have been heartbreaking. And in fact, you know, she had a really hard life after the war and suffered a lot of PTSD. From then, I've kind of thought, I really want to explore that experience of all of those amazing, brilliant, talented women who were doing all of these demanding, serious, difficult tasks during the war. And then after the war, nobody believed that women had any played a part in the war, because all they saw was that the men were the ones in the uniforms. They were the ones at the front lines. They were the ones with the guns in their hands. So they were war was about men. It wasn't about women. And so they were forgotten, they were ignored, they were shunned, they were told to be quiet, they were told that they didn't do those things. So they did start being quiet, they didn't speak up, and all their stories stayed within them and they died. You know, the big thing about Alex especially is I had so many messages, emails from readers saying, oh my goodness, my mum or my dad, particularly mums and grandmas, you know, were in the war. She was a staffetta in Italy, or she was in the RENS, or she was in the WAF, or she was in one of those auxiliary armed forces. And she never talked to me about it. And I don't know what she did. And now that I've read your book, I really want to know. And I wished that I had taken the time to just ask more questions or somehow find a way to get her to open up about that. And it was that made me want to write Alex, that idea of, you know, so I guess she is an amalgamation in a way of maybe many of those women who felt ignored after the war and who felt as if the world had taken its pound of flesh from them when it needed them, and then it kind of chewed them up and spat them out, and what if that felt like for them. So that's where she comes from.
I could not love that answer more, and I wish if anyone could see me, I'm literally almost going to end up with whiplash because I'm nodding my head so much here as you're talking, because that is entirely the experience of so many women across the board. And I, Lee Miller, I'm so fascinated now you've told me about that connection to Lee Miller. Now it all joins up. I get that, because Lee Miller was this incredible character. Years ago, I interviewed her son Anthony for article, for Marie Claire magazine. And he was fascinated because he knew nothing about his mother's experiences of the war.
I know.
She literally took all her photographs and put them up in the attic.
I
mean, like, I know. Talk about a metaphor, you know, like she literally took every memory. And so far as he was concerned, his mom, in his words, was an angry, drunk woman.
Drunk, exactly.
No idea. And he said, after her death, I went up to the attic and I started clearing and I started pulling out these boxes. Yeah. And out came this enormous sort of flood of work that she had done, these beautiful, searing portraits that she'd taken of, you know, the French collaborators having their hair shaved after the war. The image of a dead German. I mean, this was a woman that went into the concentration camps, didn't she, with the American liberator. I mean, no wonder the woman suffered PTSD and sought sanctuary at the bottom of a bottle. But yeah, so he suddenly realised that there was this whole other life to his mum, and that she was this war hero, essentially, wasn't she? And FYI, I really hope that there was talk of a film about Lee Miller being made with Kate Winslet. That gets made, because she, I think she'd do justice to that. But she was quite a woman, wasn't she? You know, travelling across Europe with a knuckle duster and a bottle in her bag.
And she used to store jerry cans of fuel on the balcony of her room at the Hotel Scribe in Paris, because, you know, fuel was so precious. And you can just imagine her room. But I love the fact that Anthony Penrose was the one that resurrected Lee Miller. You know, he found her legacy and he said, look at this amazing woman. So thank goodness that he did that. I think, you know, he's heroic too for doing that.
Absolutely. And he's created a whole archive. And in fact, what I'll do is I'll put a link to that archive on here, so anybody that wants to find out and look at those photographs can. But what's interesting about that is that he was able to do that, and he dedicated his life to creating this archive to his mother's work. But how many other Lee Millers are there out across the world whose life is still hidden in attics and trunks and boxes, and who never revealed the depth of what they did? And I'm passionate about this as well, about these forgotten women just hidden in the history books or the margins of history, because they're just women, you know, they're just housewives, they're just factory workers. They weren't in a uniform, but actually there are so many women out there with rich, vivid, incredible lives that they lived, vivid lives that they lived through the war. So, you know, I think it was so wonderful that you did that with Alex, and it makes sense now you tell me about Lee Miller, and I think, okay, I see where she's channeling all that blistering anger. And my favourite passage, if you permit me just reading it out, I loved it so much. When I read it, I actually stopped and put the book down to digest it, because I thought, yes, this sums it up for me. Where Alex said at the end, I'm the woman who loves you, but I'm also the woman who would not be home in time for dinner, let alone in time to organise a dinner party. A woman who would be utterly unlike any other partner of any other man you know, and who a year's time would not accept that you would get a mistress. A woman who never wants to be less than the man she is with. I love that last line. For me, that sums up what's so great about that character.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I loved writing her. She was probably the character I've had the most fun writing. And she was quite hard to wrangle onto the page, actually. So she was fun, but very challenging. She probably is that one character that has been the hardest to get right, because you've got to strike that balance between the vulnerability and the sadness, the deep sadness that a lot of those women carried, but also making her likable and appealing to readers. So walking that line could often be challenging. Yeah.
But I think that's what makes her such an interesting character, because she is so flawed, as she would have been living through the war, particularly in the act of resistance that she carried out. A lot of women carried that inherent sadness, and that, not that they ever called it post-traumatic stress, but that's undoubtedly what it was. And I had a very similar thing with Ruby in my book, who witnessed the Bethnal Green tube disaster and so turned to escape in a bottle. So you do try to walk that line between flawed, likable, you know, she's so many different shades of color, and I think that's what makes her so real and relatable, because we are like that as human beings. We aren't two-dimensional.
Yes, absolutely. And same with Ruby. I mean, she's a great example too. I mean, she just, you know, blasts onto the page with this, you know, ballsy kind of, you know, brassy humor and everything, but then you see what's behind that, and that's what makes you want to read more about them. So you're right, it is part of life, isn't it?
But funnily enough, Ruby is slightly linked to Lee Miller as well, because I remember seeing an exhibition at the Imperial War Museum, and there was a display cabinet, and it had Lee Miller's knuckle duster and her hip flask. And I remember thinking, I want a character that has those items in a handbag. So Ruby walks around East London with a knuckle duster and a hip flask. And I thought, those two items seem to sum her up, as I do, I think they do at Alex as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think what else your book really sums up or does so beautifully is that dichotomy of the sort of bleakness and savagery of war, but also that post-war determination to kind of look forward. And I think that was particularly prevalent in Paris, wasn't it, with the emergence of the new look. And there was this, this desire for glamour and froth and elegance. And you managed to embody that with Alex working for Dior and getting behind him and as he embodied this new look. And that tells such a bigger story of what happened in the years after war. And that's what I like, where I think really good historical fiction does so well, because you're not just telling an isolated war story, you're setting it against the context of a bigger, wider picture. So onto a research, that thorny issue of research. Yes. I can tell your books are meticulously researched. And to me, it's always a never-ending battle to know how much research to put in. Because I love it, it's my happy place, and I'd easily procrastinate for years in research and maybe never write a word. And how do you walk that line with research? Because it's obvious you've done so much. How do you learn how to sort of apply it with a lighter hand?
Challenging. And I'm a bit like you. I always say, put me in a dusty archive and I'm perfectly content. I love the research part of it too. And, you know, all those facts, I feel like if someone was able to take the top of my head off and look inside, they would just think, what a lot of junk lives in there. All of these bizarre, microscopic, obscure facts that I've gleaned over the years. But I think for me, the way that I do it is, I know a lot of historical fiction authors particularly like to plot and plan their books out in advance and then do a lot of the research first and then sit down and start writing the book. And I'm a little bit the opposite, and I really do very little research up front, and I really write a first draft because I'm a super organized person in every single area of my life, except somehow when it comes to writing, my creativity refuses to be organized and to operate to any kind of plan. So for me, that means that I've got to figure out what the story is first, because story always comes first. People come to historical fiction for the fiction, for a story to be swept away and caught up in something. And then underneath that, all the facts and the history and the research are just hanging there like, you know, the iceberg that the Titanic hit. I think there's 90% stuff under
there. That's a really good metaphor. Yeah, I really like that.
You know, it makes the 10% work, but they come for the 10% and they walk away with the bonus kind of 90%. That's all kind of the foundations there. So I've got to get that story that sits on the top, that bright, shiny thing that everyone comes for, right in my, I've got to know what that is before I can go away and really research that. So I'll write a first draft, and in that first draft process, I'll usually read one, maybe two books that cover broadly the topic that I'm writing about. So for example, in The Three Lives of Alexandre, it was Dior's autobiography that I read to get a feel for life at the house of Christian Dior in 1947. And I also read one book about Alan Dulles, who was the man who ran the Swiss station of OSS during the Second World War, which is where Alex works during the Second World War. So there's two books that gave me, and I read them, you know, over that whole period of writing that first draft. So that might be over a period of 3 months. So it's just literally two books and that's it. So I'm writing and there's lots of holes and gaps as I'm writing, but I'm finding out what that story is. And I'm writing that really quickly, that first draft, just trying to get to, I always feel like the end of the story is just there, and if I slow down, it'll vanish. So I'm always trying to catch the end of the story.
Yeah.
And then once I've got that first draft with all of its gaps and holes and notes to myself, I need to find out more about this, etc., that almost acts as my research blueprint. And it gives me the scope of my research. So if I was to research before I wrote that first draft, I wouldn't know what to research and when to stop, because I don't know what the story is, so I don't know what my boundaries are. Whereas now I've got my first draft, my research is to fill in the gaps in that draft. So now I need to find out about this and this, and so now I have to go and find those research sources. And then the second draft is all about, as well as improving the story now that I know what it is, it's about layering that research into that second draft. So I feel like that helps me to always keep prioritizing that story, because that's what's come first. And I only need to include the research facts in that second draft that help to support what I've got there or to exemplify what I've got there, for example. So I guess, you know, a really good example is that I wanted Alex because I knew that Paris in 1947 was, there were a lot of grand balls there because it was that post-war period where everyone was trying to forget the war and these kinds of things happened. And so I kind of had this set piece scene that was going to take place at some kind of ball, but I didn't know what that was going to be. I had to find it in the research. And so then in reading Dior's autobiography, he talked about going to this ball that was held on the Piscine de Ligny in Paris in 1947. And the Piscine de Ligny was basically a floating swimming pool on the Seine River in Paris. So because as if the Seine's not enough water, you've got to stick a swimming pool on top of it, floating in a wooden barge. And it was
Paris.
It was a Venetian ball. It had all the Venetian kind of artifacts and backdrops. And I thought, wow, that just sounds fabulous. So I'm going to use that in my book. So that I already had the scene I needed, but then it was layering in the details of that. It was on this wooden barge that was a swimming pool, and these were kind of all the things that you would see at the ball, and really making the setting and the description and the detail come to life in that scene. So that's how it works for me, and I think that helps. I always do include too much in my draft that goes to my publisher, and the extra scenes that I've just wanted to put in because I found this amazing research fact that I love, so I made a scene around it, and then I don't actually need that, so it comes out in the end. But I don't mind doing that.
Yeah, it's part of the process. But that's so interesting. Exactly. That you're always prioritizing the story. The story is king and queen, isn't it, essentially? And I think that's embodied by this really wonderful quote I read recently by Barnes & Noble that said, reading nonfiction allows us to learn about the past. Reading historical fiction allows us to be moved by the past. And I think that for me, that word moved sums it up, because if you can emotionally capture your reader and give them these wonderful characters that they fall in love with and they invest in you, you're going to take them all the way. And then, like you say, those little bits of history drip feeding in are like a bonus content in a sense, aren't they? But that's such good advice to anyone wanting to move into historical fiction, isn't it? That don't get too bogged down. You know, have your bedrock, have the bit below the water surface, but like you say, that bright shiny point up at the top, that's what's going to keep picking the book back up again.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that Barnes & Noble quote. In fact, it's interesting. I had this character in a previous book of mine called The Paris Secret. He was a writer, and he was talking about, you know, that whole thing about writing history. And what he basically says is that they're walking past, you know, St. James's Palace and the clock's at the top there. And he's talking about how, you know, a book of nonfiction can tell you when the clock was hung, what it's made of, all those facts. But a historical novel will tell you what it felt like to be the man up the top, hanging the clock with no scaffolding, no ropes, you know, back, you know, hundreds of years ago. That's what it's all about, what it felt like to be that person at that time.
Yeah, feelings, emotionals, and that really visceral element to books that you do so wonderfully. What did things feel like? What did they taste like? What did they smell and sound like? I love that, all the way you layer those qualities into your writing. So tell us about what's next, the next book coming up.
So I've got a book coming up called The Disappearance of Astrid Brickard, and it will be out in Australia later this year, in the US in February 2024, and in the UK in April 2024. And this time I have plunged headfirst into the 1970s, which has been so much fun. There's a character in The Three Lives of Alex St. Pierre called Mitza Brickard, and she went down in history as Christian Dior's muse, but actually she was an incredibly talented fashion designer. She was his assistant designer, in fact, according to all of the archival records that people ignore. And so Mitza is written about as a scantily clad, you know, seductress who was, you know, evilly seducing Dior into creating these amazing gowns, when actually she was designing half of them for him. So I wanted to write about, how is it that these incredibly talented women become footnotes to the men who are the ones who are remembered forever after as being the creators? And why is it always women occupying the role of muse? And what does that very complicated relationship mean? So to do that, Mitza is a character. So we're spanning from 1917, which is kind of when Mitza was a teenager, right through to present day, with a big chunk set in the 1970s. So it's a very big, ambitious story, which is hugely fun to write. And I just loved exploring, you know, 1970s music, New York in the 1970s, kind of very early disco scene, the nightclub scene, the fashion. And it's kind of also centered around the fashion battle of Versailles in 1973, when the French and the Americans went head to head to see who was the greatest fashion designers in the world, and the Americans won, and
really?
The French were shocked. Yes,
you have such a magpie's eye for things that glitter in history that are often hidden under layers. You seem to be able to have this heat-seeking radar to go in and find that, because what a wonderful thing to find a woman whose history has just reductively reduced to the role of muse, and actually shine a light into the strength of what she actually did and what she actually achieved is amazing. So that's another wonderful book, I know.
Yes, looking forward to that one coming out.
So how do you walk that line between truth and fiction? How much of the real story do you weave in, and what do you decide to leave out?
So I do, if I'm writing about a real person from history, try to stick to as much as I possibly can about the kind of facts. But even the facts that are on record are often wrong. I mean, in that case of Mizar Ricard, for example, everybody takes one anecdote that was reported once. And these days, I know that you're a journalist, and I don't mean this in any way to be negative against journalists, but often journalists do just repeat that one fact. And if the fact was wrong the first time, it becomes wrong 100 times afterwards. So often the facts themselves are wrong. So there is this, and you know, we can never know what someone felt in every moment of time. But when we're writing about someone from the past, we're writing about how they felt. So we're already lying. We're putting dialogue in their mouth. We're doing all of those things. So when I say I try to stick to the facts, I do that within the framework of knowing I'm making up everything anyway. And I'm often adding in fictional people around them. So the whole thing is kind of this, it's almost a pastiche of fact anyway. So it is fiction. I always say that. And, you know, there are always people who will like to point out when you get a fact wrong. But for me, those people should really be reading nonfiction, because if what you want is the facts, then don't come to historical fiction looking for the facts, because it says in its title, historical fiction. So it's a made up world. It's made up stories. We're putting words in people's mouths. So I always think that it's important that you've got to have fun, and you don't want to have the facts become so rigid and so constraining to you as a writer that you feel like you're kind of, you know, stuck in this box and you can only write it in this one particular way. If you're doing that, I say, you know, break out and just play faster and have a bit of fun. Exactly. You know, and I always say the author's note is your get out of jail free card. That's where you confess to everything that you did that was not
I love that. That's so true. You're so right, because I had a very similar thing with the wartime library. It was actually in reality, it was a male librarian down there. But I felt that, and somebody, of course, pointed that out. How could I do that fast and loose? And you're right, I did use my get out of jail card at the end to kind of to clarify that. But I felt, given the wider context of the treatment of women at that time and the way that women were operating within librarianship and reading, that I was acting with emotional integrity, and it conceivably could have been a woman. So I think, you know, using that as a kind of loose framework, I felt that I was justified in doing so. And I think you did a similar thing with Alex, didn't you, that as working at Christian Dior, she could have done it, she would have done it, and to, you know, to make it relatable to women readers as well.
Exactly. And you know, it is fiction, so you're saying to people, let's come and look at what this world might have been like if a woman was there. And that's a fun story, and that's, people like that kind of stuff. So I don't find anything wrong with that. In fact, I think it's great to look at those alternative what if scenarios.
Yeah. And actually, because you and I both know how much of women's contribution to, you know, the social, the economic, the political, the cultural history of World War II has been so downplayed, it's not unfeasible that these things did happen. So in a way, I suppose it's us allowing our characters the freedom to do that. So, and fun, like you say, as well, getting swept up along in the ride. So
yeah.
so interesting. The next question is really about plotting. I think you might have sort of already answered this actually, but how much do you plot in advance? Do you, personally, I'm a bit of a control freak. I like to know where I'm going. I like to know what the beginning, you know, I wouldn't get in a car journey without going, knowing where I'm going. So I like to know the beginning, the middle and the end. Yes, I can have fun and play around and go off on strange segues in between that. But I sort of like to have a framework. Do you feel that way? I think you touched on that when you said you were writing and you were almost herring towards the end because you knew you want to get to that point. How do you work in that respect?
I'm a total control freak too, and that's why I find first drafts so terrifying, because it's the one moment in my life, really, I guess, where I have no control, because I really don't know what I'm doing. I can easily get, you know, not even more than 7/8 of the way through a book and not know how it's going to end. And that's terrifying, because it's, I think, oh, what if it doesn't? What if there is no end? What if I don't know what the end is? You know, I really get quite stressed out about all of that. So I always feel like it would be more relaxing to write with a plan. But then another writer, I can't remember who it was talking about how for them, part of the fun of writing the first draft is to find out what the story is and to unravel the end. So if they knew that in advance, then for them, the first draft wouldn't be as fun. I thought, oh, maybe that's how my mind works. Maybe I'm actually entertaining and amusing myself as I'm telling myself this story. And you know, if you kind of know the end of a book, sometimes you might put it down because you don't need to read it. So maybe that's why I don't know it, because I
to give it
need
to not know it.
Exactly.
So jeopardy. Yeah,
exactly. So I don't know. And in fact, I always say, I find it quite stressful, but there are many times that where I can look back and go, I'm so glad I didn't know the plot, because then when that surprise twist came to me as I was writing, I was so genuinely surprised by that, that I feel like the reader will then be too. So that's kind of a nice feeling. So it has its pros, but it definitely has its cons in terms of my control freakish nature being very tense while I'm, you know, just flying by the seat of my pants, hoping it all kind of works out. So,
and it always does work out, but I agree. When you're a control freak, like, well, I think you and I have that in common. It's quite difficult to relinquish control and allow the story just to go where it goes, where it wants to go. I always think it's quite nice if you have an idea, but allow yourself the freedom to go off the page almost. So like with my character with Ruby, you know, they were just, the war was going to end and she was going to stay and help look after her mother. And actually somewhere along the line, she fell in love with the GI, and suddenly I thought, God, Ruby would really want to be a best-selling historical fiction writer. And so she goes off to New York and pursues this bright, amazing future. And I suddenly thought, yeah, that was never in the plan, but why can't I allow that? Why can't I allow her that? So yeah, you can allow those moments of with a character, because you've become so embedded with that character. You've come, you know, you've lived and breathed it for so long. Suddenly they tell you what they want to do. And I love that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what we all, why we write, it's for those pleasurable surprises that we just go, oh yes, you know, those moments where it's like, oh, I love that, I'm such a genius.
And maybe it's because we're control freaks rather, that we can control the outcome of things. You know, we get to say what happens to them, where they live or die. That's the ultimate control freakery, isn't it?
Yes. We're like gods.
Gods in our little offices. So what's your routine, Natasha? What, given that you have three children and a busy life, how do you have a routine, or is it a sort of reasonably relaxed routine? How does it work for you? How do you get words on the page?
No, as a control freak, I like my routine. And I find that helps me, A, feel like I know that I'm going to get my deadlines met, which are obviously really important to us as writers. But it also allows the rest of the household to function smoothly, because we know what things are going to happen in the course of a day. So most sort of every second day I'll go for a run. I'm a big believer that running is actually part of my creative process, because there's something about being out there. I have a soundtrack for every book, which doesn't mean that the songs are related to the book in a kind of the way most people would consider that, but there's something about the lyrics of that song that make me think of one of my characters. With those words flowing through my head as I'm pounding the pavement, my imagination is kind of working and conjuring up scenes and dialogue and that kind of thing. So I always get back from a run and often be scribbling down some notes that might have just come to me while I'm running.
That's so fascinating. Yeah. It's almost like an audio mood board.
Yes, exactly. Oh my God, that's exactly what it
is. That's what you're doing. I love that. Yes. That's brilliant.
Yes, I'm so glad you've given me a word for it too. That's perfect.
Now you know what it is you're doing. But I guess that absolutely fully enables you to immerse yourself in that time period. And then when you come to the page, you're writing already in the 1970s because you've got the words of, I don't know, Fleetwood Mac or whoever going through your head.
Yes, exactly.
Genius. Absolute genius. I love that. I'm going to borrow that. I don't run, but I do walk every morning.
Exactly.
And I love that. Yeah, it's almost meditative, isn't it? That one foot in front of the other.
Yes.
Then you can really think through your story. So, okay, so you do walk every other day, your run.
Yeah, so I do that, and then I'm usually at my desk around 8:30-ish. You know, the kids, I drop my daughters off at the bus at 7:30. My husband takes my son. I've done my run by then, get myself organized, sit down at my desk, and I usually clear emails for the first half an hour or so because, like you, probably everything comes in overnight from the US and the UK, so I've got to deal with all of that in the morning. And sometimes those things are quite urgent, so I try and do a good half hour of that. I know people say that you should never attack your email inbox first thing in the morning. You should get into your writing, but I just would be thinking about my inbox the whole time, and I wouldn't be able to concentrate. So for me, control freak, got to get that done.
No, same, same.
And then I basically write from, you know, 9-ish till around 3:30 when the kids finish up school, and I write in half-hour blocks because I've discovered now that I am this advanced age that writing is very bad for your back. If you sit there for 2 hours, 3 hours without moving, you end up with a non-functional back. So I literally have a timer that goes off every half an hour, and I get up and I, for 10 minutes, I'll go make up a tea, or I'll, you know, put away the dishes or do something so that I'm moving, and then I go sit back down and write for half an hour. It's a bit like the Pomodoro kind of method, but it's my own kind of take on that. So that just keeps my body moving, and I find that I'm as productive, or actually more productive, writing in half hour blocks as I would be if I sat there for 2 or 3 hours, because I don't feel like, for me, I write for that whole 2 or 3 hours. I get bored and distracted. This way, I'm not getting bored and distracted. So I just do that for the whole day. I take sort of 45 minutes to an hour off for lunch, and I'll always be reading a research book while I'm eating my lunch and making notes while I'm doing that. And then it's back to writing for the afternoon. And sometimes that might be till sort of 4:30, depending on what the kids have got on, if they're at school late. And then usually I'm back at my desk for about half an hour every night, so around 7:30-ish, just kind of doing admin stuff. Might be invoicing, it might be social media, it might be writing my Substack newsletter, all of those kinds of things that we have
it's
to
about
do.
Breaking it down into sort of manageable chunks, isn't it?
And
removing this myth of the idea that you have to sit there for hours and hours and hours, and you have thousands of words every day. I think it's quality over quantity a lot of the time, isn't it? And that sum that up beautifully. That's so fascinating. I love that. It's very similar to my own, actually, as well. Can sort of bookended with the kids either end of the day and then clearing away all the emails and then just losing yourself.
Yeah.
Well, you can. So what next for you, Natasha? I know you have some exciting news. I don't know if you're able to share it here.
Yes. So I have just signed. In fact, the contract came through. The official contract was like yesterday, the day before I was signing that, for 2 new books with Ballantine, which is part of Penguin Random House, who I'm so excited to work with, for a book called, working title, The Secret Life of Marie Madeleine. And there was a woman called Marie Madeleine Merrick, was her name during the war. Later, she might be known as Marie Madeleine Foucard after she was remarried. She was the only female leader of a French resistance network during the Second World War. She led 3,000 agents during the Second World War. All the other resistance networks were led by men, but she kind of has been, again, left off the history books because she didn't align herself with Charles de Gaulle initially, because he was in London and she was providing intelligence to the British rather than to the Free French initially, because there was some kind of miscommunication, I guess you could say. And so Charles de Gaulle initially was not happy with her, and so he kind of kept her out of quite a few of the recognition ceremonies for resistance fighters after the war. So that's where she became forgotten. She's since been somewhat resurrected, but I feel like I can't believe nobody's written a novel about her, and I'm so excited that they haven't, because I really want to write this book about her. Well, I'm well into writing this book about her. So she was amazing. She escaped from prison like 3 times. She gave birth to a baby whilst on the run from the Gestapo. She lasted for the whole war, whereas most resistance leaders sadly were deported or died a lot of the time. So many of her agents were killed or deported to concentration camps. She was amazing, strong, powerful, incredible.
I'm already in love with
this book. Three children, you know, wow. Amazing. So, yeah, you know, the leader of... Yeah, at 30 years old, she was the leader of a network. Incredible. That's
incredible. And so tragic in a way that women like that were sort of just sidelined really after yes. the war ended. And so wonderful that in a sense what you're writing here is this revisionist history. You're giving this woman yes. back her voice that's been stolen from her. I cannot yeah. wait to read that book. That is me all over. I'm going to literally devour that when it comes out. So congratulations on that, because I know that's a big deal, and I've no yeah. doubt blaze into the sort of literary stratosphere or whatever when it comes out. Natasha, I always ask my interviews three final questions, I suppose link back to the point of this podcast, which is From the Library with Love. If you had to, it's a very difficult question, but if you had to, what would be your favourite childhood book?
Oh, Little Women, for sure. I read Little Women by Louisa May Alcott about a bazillion times when I was young. I've still got my childhood copy of it, in fact.
No,
I wanted to see Amy March. Amy March was my childhood hero. So I know everybody else is a Jo March fan, but I was Amy all. Yeah, I adored that book.
And isn't that funny how you've then gone on to write about these strong female characters, that it a lot of it must have stemmed or flown out of the pages of that book and into your head. It must have shaped you in ways you didn't even know when you were reading it.
Okay. Yeah.
That's really fascinating. And did you have a favourite library, or what was your childhood library?
We did have a library that we would go to every week, and I would check out an armload of books, because we didn't buy a lot of books when I was a kid. It was really, you know, if you wanted a book, it was from the library. And I was such a big reader that my mum started this exercise book of the names of the books in all the series I was reading. And so I could tick them off as I read them. So I could remember which books I'd read in a series and make my way through the whole series kind of, you know, almost in order sort of thing. So she's still got this book, and it's like this amazing record of my reading childhood through all the obviously In Lightens that we all read, and then the Nancy Drews, and then on to Sweet Valley High and all of those kinds of things. So it's super fun.
You're summing up my childhood reading right there, the Sweet Valley Highs. Yep. And do you know, I love that you still have that. I think in your next book, please, this is a plea from me, put that at the back of the book, like your childhood reading material. Who would not be interested to know that? That's so fascinating. Yes. Yay for your mum for keeping that as well, that record.
Yeah, I know.
And Natasha, if you were to be sent off to a desert island with only one book, what would it be?
Oh my goodness.
Oh, that's a really horrible question, that, isn't it?
I know, it's so mean. I think I probably have said this before, but I'm gonna say Jane Eyre. It's my hand on heart favorite. I always joke that all of the male heroes in my books have got dark hair and dark eyes because of my secret Rochester fantasy. Maybe it's not a joke, maybe it's real.
As a psychologist, should be listening to this.
No. Yes, it'd be Jane Eyre for sure. And you know, because choice, I think again too, you know, she's a foundational heroine in my kind of birth as a writer, because she was very shy, meek, very downtrodden at the start, and she becomes a very strong woman by the end. And I love that arc of Jane in the book.
Yeah, that's an amazing answer. And I think what a fantastic book as well to take with you. Natasha, I cannot thank you. What a joy talking to you, because I just see so many parallels in the way that you write and your passion for women's history and bringing it to life in the wonderful way that you do. I'm such a huge fan, so I'm incredibly grateful for you coming on today and sharing all those little inside tips and tricks. So thank you very, very much indeed.
Oh, it was my absolute pleasure, Kate, and the admiration is mutual. I adore your writing too. So it was just so lovely when you reached out and asked me to be a guest.
Oh, bless
on the
you. Well, who knows, one day we might be able to align the time scenes.
Yes.
Up in Australia at the same point, or London, who knows, and we'll do an event, and that will be, we will just talk for hours, I know. Thank you so much.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.